But coming up next, we've got something of a super group. We have Corner Shop sitting down there. We have Johnny Marr, and we have Gem and Noel from Oasis. So doing the classic Tomorrow Never Knows. So they go.
All right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Hope you guys are okay. We've got a fantastic episode for you today. It is with Tejinder Singh from Corner Shop. So I was really pleased when Tejinder got in touch. Had a couple of messages back and forth on Twitter and so pleased to have him on. Corner Shop, such a great band, one of the best bands that in this country's produced in the last 30 years. So such an amazing privilege to get to speak to him. And this episode is kind of a part one. Part two of my discussion with him carries on over on the 1001 Albums podcast channel, which is the new podcast I've recently set up. So if you could go and give that a listen, please, it'd be greatly appreciated. The first two episodes are up over there. First one is with Alan McGee talking Ziggy Stardust, and the second one is with Danny Burton, who you've heard from on here before and played on our Glasgow show with Tony McCarroll. And I'm talking with Danny about Tommy by The Who, because he had a crazy story, how he worked with John Entwistle, and he also almost got the gig doing Tommy on the stage. So fascinating. Go and check that out, please. I would appreciate it. And if you can review on iTunes, that's really helpful. When you've got a new podcast, reviews are a real impact on showing up on podcast charts. So if loads of you could go and review the 1001 Albums podcast, it would really get it up the charts, which would be very helpful for me. And obviously, if you haven't reviewed the Oasis podcast before, please go and review the Oasis podcast, because that would be absolutely fantastic. And the only other thing to say is thank you very much to everyone that listened to the Fantasy Band episode that we did last week. It was really good fun to do. It was great speaking to Andy, Mittal, Richard, Imran and Ian. And and thanks to everyone who voted on Twitter for the Fantasy Bands. And the winner was Mittal. So just to remind you, his band was called The Loud Experience, and it had Bez, Jimi Hendrix, Freddie Mercury, Phil Lynott and Dave Grohl. So really good band and fantastic. So Mittal will be getting a Oasis bootleg out to his address very soon. So let's crack on with this interview now with Tejinder Singh from Corner Shop.
To the heavy moons. Two, it's a little up country and it's all a little bit undefined. Winter's dark and summer's light.
So welcome to the Oasis podcast. Tejinder from Corner Shop, how you doing?
Hi there. Very good, thank you.
Are you very good, though? It's pretty hot today, and obviously we're in the middle of lockdown, so it's pretty unpleasant times, really, generally, are you finding?
I don't mind it. I mean, I've sort of got into the mindset of things being locked down. I'm locked down normally anyway, and yeah. And it's as hot as the Punjab, and so I feel quite at home.
Fair enough. And congratulations on England is a Garden. Fantastic album.
Thank you.
Have you been pleased with the reception it's had? I mean, I suppose when it came out, like, you know, it sort of coincided with all this madness, hasn't it? So it's sort of a strange one.
It has, and luckily for the album, it's helped a lot of people through the isolation that they've had to go through. We're very happy with it. We're not just happy with the album itself, but we're also happy on the light that it's shone on previous albums. And it's sort of aligned everything that we've done into a much more coherent sort of story. And obviously at this late stage of the innings, it's quite nice to surprise people and to give them something that I don't think anyone was expecting it. We weren't expecting it, so I don't think anyone else was.
Yeah. I mean, it's been great, like, because, you know, you've always had that sort of dedicated following since the late 90s. You've been put out great stuff, but it feels like this is then getting you back to like the level where the reviews have been fantastic. Like it appears, I don't know, obviously the world's different now with sales and things, but it feels like you've gone to a different level now, back up to a higher level in terms of critical acclaim and success. Is that fair?
I think so. We sort of get left out a bit. I think every time we put a single out or an album, we have to start from square one. And it's been quite frustrating. And then we took our time on this album. We wanted it to hit on a lot of different cylinders. And we think it has. And it also, therefore, puts light on what we've done in the past. And people have listened to what we've done in the past and find out that it's pretty good. It's quite compelling, but altogether, we did an interview a while ago with someone, and the story is what it's all about. When we first started, we were in it for the long run. We wanted to change a few things, and we think we have, and we've also been able to carry on for so many years, and so we're very proud of what we've achieved over the years.
No, I think so. I think you should really be proud of it, and it's, as I say, it's been great to have you back. I think the musical scene has needed you guys being back, actually, because it's felt like, you know, there's still good stuff out there, but, you know, in terms of political songs, like, but not necessarily flag waving political, but just intelligent songs with something to say. Plus also, you know, with that sort of irony and things that you often bring with your lyrics, I think that's kind of, I'm looking around the landscape and thinking, you know, where are the new sort of Tejinders and Jarvises and Neil Hannons and stuff? And I can't see that many of them. So, you know, it was great to have you back for that reason, definitely.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm qualified enough to talk about what music is going on, but certainly I don't. It's changed. The whole landscape of music has changed. The whole people are doing it after being educated in it. And so you're going to get a stricter view and I think less personalities, quite frankly, because they're schooled in what they in what they're going to be putting forward rather than doing it from merely necessity or a need for that kind of expression. They've been schooled in that expression before that expression has hit. It's a very different thing.
Mm. And, obviously this album was kind of written and recorded in sort of post-Brexit world or, you know, once the vote had happened. And you can kind of hear that, not overtly, but, you know, it's definitely a theme going through it. But then it's then been written and recorded, obviously, pre-lockdown and then everything that's been happening with the Black Lives Matter protests and everything going on at the moment. So it's come out at sort of a very strange time in that regard. And you've got the fourth track on there that literally talks about police following people around, which feels very prescient, you know, of obviously then that's the massive issue that's become in the last few months.
Everywhere that Wagami run, everywhere that Wagami run, everywhere that Wagami run, policemen follow them. They follow Pretty and Juja Singh. They follow Pretty and Juja Singh. They follow Pretty and Juja Singh. Policemen follow them.
Well, you know, we started off political. We started off because of something that happened to me in an educational environment at Polytechnic. And so all the songs have really been political. We burnt Morrissey posters right at the start. We haven't stopped being political. And whether that's political because of what the industry music industry does and it's against it, or whether it's politically in terms of parliament and politics. I mean, even Brimful talked about the government. So in a way, yes, it's nice that we sort of hit on a subject that is very now, but in another way, all of our catalogue hits on these things because it's always been there. It's not something new for us. And so if you put so much politics into it, as you say, not overt politics, but an element of humour to it and a sense of knowing certain aspects of what's going on around you, then those things will come to light. Yeah. So, you know, we didn't mean for that, the police element to be... anything in line with Black Lives Matter. But as far as we're concerned, we've been doing Black Lives Matter ever since I've been black.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I mean, so taking it back, like then you said, so, I mean, in the kind of 80s, there was loads of political music, whether it was Billy Bragg and then the Red Wedge guys and the Style Council and all these people that were... you know, being overtly political, coming out of punk and then going onwards from that. I mean, was that... I'm just really interested thinking about, you know, you forming the band initially. And it's always... I always think of, like, the Pogues. You know, the way that the Pogues, the way that Shane took Irish traditional music and infused it with punk. You know, obviously you did something that, you know, I was just been doing my research on it. I'm like, had anyone done that? You know, obviously you'd had the big rock guys like George Harrison who'd infused Indian music into their music. But I don't know if, off the top of my head, I can't think of anyone that had done the way that you did it, infusing that traditional Indian instrumentation with that rock and roll kind of Western thing. Am I missing like a huge wave of artists, or were you genuinely kind of the first people to do it?
I personally would say we were, because the overtness of what we were doing, it was overtly noisy or it was overtly political. I don't think anyone had done it quite in that manner. And also, there were some people who were Asian and doing music in the 90s, but they, going onto the other side, were they had grants. They were paid to go round Europe. They didn't do the rock and rollness that that we had to do. To even get started in music, so yeah, I'm not too sure, but
well, you sort of took it and ran with it, and then obviously from there, you know, it did become a bigger thing with like Talvin Singh winning the Mercury Prize and things like that. But once again, it hasn't then started a movement of you guys are still hard to. You know, you don't easily get categorised, like you said earlier. You don't really fit in with Britpop. You didn't really fit in with Big Beat, and then you had this kind of this Indian sound as well. So it was a tricky one in that regard, I suppose, for the industry.
No, I don't. I think that the industry is point away, but we just saw it as a reflection of all the music that we liked and the different music that we collected, and we were always big collectors of vinyl. And you know, when you talked about Billy Bragg and all that sort of stuff, that wasn't even on my radar. I was still listening to Asian music at that time. Right. So when it came to more Western music, I think I had a very different view on it to anyone else. And mine was a case of putting together a musical jigsaw that other people had had for decades, and they'd grown up with. And I think when we first started out, we were with the Riot Girl scene, because our label was very much Riot Girl.
Right.
Was the start of Riot Girl, the denomination in the UK anyway. And that was probably the only scene that we were happy to be with. I mean, you know, Asian Underground and all that crap, that was nicked from us, quite frankly. I mean, we'd done the Mod Target thing and we were actually underground. They were on major labels. So
right.
Even now, the only scene that we're very happy to be with is the Riot Girl scene, where we were honorary members by dint of our members. And we're very we're very happy to be like. Going back to what you said about the Pogues, I think that's really interesting. Ben loves the Pogues, and he knows a hell of a lot more about it than me. But I always thought it was what the punks did with reggae. Two disenfranchised sort of groups coming together because they were because they wanted to change things. And with the Riot Girl scene and with what we were doing, that's what we seriously felt that was happening. We were getting what before we were allowed onto the label. We were being we had Huggy Bear and members at the in our interviews, making sure that they accepted what we were saying. It wasn't a simple case of just contract, and obviously we got on very well with all of them.
No, that's cool. And then obviously the first couple of albums come out. And then, you know, and then we'll chat about Born for the Seventh Time in a bit. But I just wanted to get your take on, you know, so you're already kind of, you know, touring musicians and you're putting albums out. And then this sort of, as you said, you've been part of this Riot Girl kind of, you know, scene almost that happened before it. But then Britpop kind of hits and Oasis hit, and there's this sort of, you know, big, huge wave of English bands then coming out. I mean, what was that like at the time? And do you remember hearing Oasis for the first time, who you ended up working with?
I do remember, yeah. And I thought it was... I didn't think it was for me, but I thought it was big. It wasn't right. until I saw them live that it was to prove how big it was. Britpop itself was something that we at that time we were in America. Then we'd done Europe a lot, and we were over in America continually, so we sort of missed out on a lot of that. And I always maintain that Britpop really wasn't a scene. It's more of a scene now than it was then. It was an invention, and it was as you said, a category that people could be put in, and we were quite happy to keep away from it because it was made up.
So you didn't used to hang out in the Good Mixer with Menswear and Graham Coxon?
Well, I used to see Graham Coxon around, and I used to go to the Mixer, not Menswear, but that was before, that was prior to that.
Okay.
No, I think it was more of a simplicity tool by the press than anything more concrete.
Sure.
Because if you ask anyone if you point a finger to anyone who said and say that you were in Britpop, I don't think many people would put their hands up. Pulp certainly wouldn't.
No.
And they're one of the biggest perceived groups of that scene.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. I don't think anyone really does. I mean, it's funny, there's like... you can get Britpop top trumps cards that someone's put together, and one of the categories on there is "We're not Britpop" factor of which ones would actually, you know, fight against that Britpop tag, and it is it's quite funny that there's so many amazing British artists around at that time that, you know, do get lumped in with that, and you think like what, you know, it's a funny old tag anyway. But I suppose all of them are, whether it's punk or whatever, they're it's just a bit bizarre, isn't it, I suppose?
I suppose it is, yeah.
So what about when you actually then... When did you sort of get to meet the Oasis guys for the first time, and how do you then end up supporting them?
It's a very, very hazy when we look back to those times. But I think we met Noel in England backstage at a show. And I think that was when we thought, well, we're going to get on with them, and therefore we look forward to the tour, because before that their reputation was quite rough, and so it was debatable on how we would get on with each other, but as soon as we spoke to Noel, it was pretty evident that it was going to be quite easy. But the tour itself with Oasis in America happened because of two different things. One was that Liam was in a hotel room and he heard a song on MTV, and he called his brother, who was in another room, and said, "Switch MTV on." And they started hearing this song and started singing to it, even though it was in Punjabi, and they kept on listening to it because it sort of knocked them out. And that was Jalinder Sher. That was our track, Jalinder Sher. And then the next element was that their manager, Marcus Russell, had seen us in New York, and he told them that they should tour with us. And he described us to them as Velvet Underground with sitars, and that was sold.
Well, yeah, that would do it, wouldn't it? I suppose that would sell it. Originally seen you on the thing, you'd set up the thing, and then you ended up getting like doing that whole meeting backstage sort of after they kind of already agreed to get you on the tour.
They'd agreed, and then we happened to see Noel in a backstage in London.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. And he was very sharp and quite cutting, and but he was also very down to earth and easy to talk to as well.
Yeah, well, that's great. But,
yeah, you know, like with people like Ian Brown, they're quite they're northern, and there's an attitude to what they say rather than them just saying things, and so you never know you never know what's going to happen.
Okay. But Noel, you felt comfortable around.
Yeah. And then Liam really was the same, but probably even sharper.
Yeah.
In a very blunt way. And I say that, and I said it before, that you know, you'd speak to him, and after a minute you'd just think, okay, what's this? And then 5 minutes, you'd think, oh, he's a bit crazy. And then 10 minutes, you'd think, he's definitely crazy. And then on the 12th minute, he would say something that wraps everything that he said in one big blow. And that's... and you just think, well, he's a genius, because that's how he came across. He didn't come across as a normal person. He came across as... I don't know, just... very otherworldly.
Yeah. Well, he does have an interesting turn of phrase, doesn't he, Liam? And it's not even like a... he comes out with things that... it's almost John Lennon-like, in that there's this absurdity to it.
Yeah.
But then actually it makes a lot of sense. And you think he's not... obviously he's had no training in poetry or anything like that. He's just... I suppose he's just wired a little bit differently.
Yeah. He chucks things... he chucks whatever is in his head at you. And you... you're therefore put into a different world, because people don't chuck those things at you normally.
And, yeah, it very much confuses Americans on Twitter, because he's, as I say, he comes out with this sort of random stuff on Twitter now, and, you know, and actually a few of us then have to sort of jump in and explain, like, all this range of different cultural things, or whether it's from a, you know, an 80s TV advert or whatever it's from. But, yeah, it is very bizarre. Oh, that's cool. But anyway, how were the US shows then? And did you enjoy that whole process of playing with them? That was on the Be Here Now tour, so it was a pretty intense time by all accounts.
Yeah, it was in January 1998.
Yeah,
it was for most of the month of January, and then it went into February. We didn't know really what to expect. As I said, we'd been to America quite a lot anyway. We just got the album of the year with Spin. We just got the John Peel Festive 50 with Brimful. And then there was, I think at Christmas, there would have been white labels of Brimful going about as well.
Right.
So really everything for us was just ticking over, and every day was very different. And we got there, and we had a sleeper bus that we travelled around in. We had two lighting people and a very small sort of entourage. We didn't really know how it would go, but after the first gig, we then went backstage, and everything was pretty good from then. And it was a big scale, six sort of lorries, large lorries of equipment, but the group themselves would be going from gig to gig via planes to reduce the element of friction. And we never really saw any friction. I've spoken to Saf's, our sitar player, and he said that he noticed they did have a go at each other at the first gig, but that was all that he saw.
Right.
The two brothers. We got on with them really well. And then we also got on with their crew as well, who, after the first night, they would create a space for us, stage space for us. Paolo Hewitt was there, and Phil Smith was doing the DJing throughout the tour. And Maggie Mouzoukatis. Was the tour manager. And we really got on well with Gwigsy as well. Very well, possibly too well. And his roadie was Roger Knoll. And Roger then became one of our roadies after that. But we'd go to different gigs, and we'd always look for Roger, who always had something in his pocket for us, which was rather good of him. It was big scale, and it was wonderful. Everyone really got on. We had a really good laugh with them. We listened to lots of music in their backstage area. I think looking back on it, I think because our music, again, was so different to theirs in a way, that was another good reason for us to get on. There was no hostility, but even though the musics were very different, the groups got on without treading on each other's feet at all. So that was a good aspect of it.
Sleep on the left side, leave the right side free. Hope gets salted as those around you leave. We're gonna let it up like India house on fire. We're gonna let it go and let it go higher. Let it go.
Were the crowds turning up to watch you guys as well, or was it that sort of frustrating support band thing of, you know, not that many people being there? How are you finding that?
No, these were auditoriums. They were packed. And we always got a great response. This was America. I think in England it might have been different with an Oasis crowd. But in America, they loved us. And we've got people, many people, following us from those days.
It's fantastic. And meanwhile, as I say, because this is Jan and then into Feb 98... Mm. And obviously Brimful of Ash had come out as a single from the album, and then you've got this behemoth coming. That, I mean, did you know what was the situation at that time? Was that primed to come out at that point?
Yes, as I said, they were playing white labels of it at all the Christmas shows. DJs were sort of fighting each other as to who was going to play it, so we knew that it was going to be big. And Noel said it will be number one, and to enjoy it. So that was rather nice as well.
There's dancing behind movie scenes, behind the movie scenes. Sadi Rani, she's the one that keeps the dream alive. From the morning past the evening to the end of the life. Bring food, that you're on the 45, well, it's a grim fool that you're on the 45.
Cool. Well, you did do some shows with them in the UK as well. How was that?
I think we only did one show, and that was at Finsbury Park.
Finsbury Park, yeah.
Yeah. Well, for us, it was great. Some of the reaction that I've read about is that we were bottled off. We weren't bottled off. we did the gig, and there was certainly a lot of bottles with piss being chucked around, but that's just how it goes when
it's par for the course.
When you've got a crowd like that. Yeah, I don't think we played with them other than that. But we did then go back to... Well, we went back to play with them in Las Vegas. And that was just before they played Coachella and we played Coachella as well. But I think we played on different days.
Okay.
So we did the gig in Las Vegas, which was very Las Vegas. I think it was in the same venue that the chap from The Who died with a few prostitutes around him about a month later. And that was good. Noel actually used to come on stage and play most gigs with us for the last song. And also Saf Sitaris used to go on and play with them as well for one track.
This is Saf from Corner Shop. Since this is the last gig of the tour, I said nice one to Corner Shop, so I'm not for this film. It's really good. When you're ready, right?
And Ben went in as well. Went on stage with them as well sometimes. But I think Fading Out. Is what Sash used to come on stage. Yeah. So he was introduced. So, you know, that's how we got on. We just... It was very mutual. And and everyone enjoyed it.
Cool. And then what about then Noel playing on Spectral Morning? How did that all come about?
Because he'd played bass on Jill and the Share, which was an Asian track, I thought that he'd be okay to do. He would be up for doing something on another Asian track that we had. And we asked him, and he said yes. And we didn't really think that much of it until his equipment arrived the day before. And that was quite strange, just seeing lots of amps and a hell of a lot of guitars. he was lovely, very down to earth, came and joined us in the pub after. He didn't just do a couple of guitar lines and that was it. He did plenty. He must have done about 15 takes of different types of guitar. And that's why it then became a 24-hour thing that we did, because he'd done so bloody many guitars, which was, quite a lot of work to cut it all out and produce it. But it was wonderful. Again, it was quite effortless, you know. He obviously liked the track, else he wouldn't have put that much effort into it. Mm. And it was all quite natural.
One, isn't it? Because, as you say, it's a very Asian-influenced track, in that it's one of those ones that's only on sort of one or two chords. And Oasis get criticised for only using sort of three or four chords, but, you know, this is sort of the Eastern tradition of only sort of sitting on one or two chords. And so it does mean that, I suppose, it gives you that freedom, because you're not having to worry, but then it could also be quite limiting, I suppose. So it's not... I suppose it'd be quite a tricky one, but I think he does very, very well on it. I think it's very interesting.
Well, he did chords, he did notes, and he did noise, and he did atmosphere. So it was all. But yes, it wasn't too difficult. But he makes it sound like Oasis, which is great.
Is that what you kind of wanted, I suppose? Or?
No, we just wanted him to do whatever he thought was pertinent. Turned out he did the best guitar of his career.
Certainly the most guitar, probably the longest that he's played in the track. But I think it's great. Collaboration, and I actually talked to Mary McGuigan, Gwigsy's sister, about this the other day. It was a question that came up about, how did Gwigsy playing on Lessons Learned, how did that sort of come about? And they said that he had a home studio at the time, and it was because you guys were recording there. Is that how did that end up coming about? I mean, you said that you'd become quite close to Gwigs on the tour.
Yeah. Well, he did our home studio, and we went and visited it, I think, a couple of times. But he was also hanging around with some Rastas at the time, and that's where the Motion 11 comes from. they were friends of Griggs's, the Jack and Kojak, that did the vocals for that,
right.
Did the male vocals on that track. I think he was still in Oasis when he did the bass for us, because we actually finished the album. We finished that in 2001 and just sat on it until we found a better time to put it out, which was a year or so later. The recording was done in Preston, and he'd gone to see Bonehead in Manchester, and so after he'd done that, he came and saw us in Preston, and I think he came about 10 o'clock, and we were quite thick into the, well, I was thick into the mixing of stage in the Plaguing of the Raised Platform, which is also on that album, and we didn't want to lose momentum on that. We wanted to get it done, and so that took about 4 hours, and he hung around, took it very easy, and again it was very nice of him. He could have really got fucked up. but he wasn't like that, so we carried on, and then he did the bass, which he did perfectly well the first time, and we got him to do a second time just to make sure we had one for safety. But that was that. And then he got in the car about 4 o'clock in the morning and went off to back to North London.
Reporting damage in a soft rock ship. The TSB rock school, the overgrown super ship. The supermodels, all they can get enough of it. The overgrown super ship against the GTX, it was rugged GT. Lessons learned from Rocky 1 to Rocky 3. Lesson 1, the AMRs are in it to the hips.
Fantastic, and it's great. And like I was just mentioned on Twitter, actually, it's the last album that both Noel Gallagher and Griggs play on, because obviously he didn't play on. Well, even this came out after Standing on the Shoulder, which there's a question of whether he plays on anyway. But yeah, that is, you've officially got the last album that those two particular members of Oasis play on.
Wow.
Legacy for you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's good. Well, I also knew Gem, who just before he'd been invited to be in Oasis, but before he'd actually gone to see them, I was having breakfast with him and a mutual friend, well, his family as well, actually, and my family, in Crouch End. And so he was asking me what it was like, and I was telling him what my recollections of the gigs were, which were probably a lot more together than what I can remember now.
Right, fair enough. Well, so there you go. If you told Gem, oh no, you don't want to be part of that Oasis, the world could have been very different.
It could have been. We could have all been a lot happier.
The other one that's sort of tied in with, you know, the Oasis world, which I just think is one of the coolest things, is that you worked with Mike Flowers, who was obviously famous for Wonderwall, and this was a track that kind of bypassed me, and it was only, I interviewed Mike for the Oasis podcast, and I love that stuff you did with him. What I've read was that, you know, that people had said that project sounded a bit Mike Flowers. And then so you just thought, right, let's go and get Mike Flowers then. Is that fair?
It's pretty fair enough, yeah. I knew his drummer. So I got in touch with the drummer and said, these people are saying this. And actually, it's not a bad idea. So so he did it. What was really nice about that, actually, was that he could have just said, all right, he could have declined. But he went with it. And then not only did he go with it, he then fell in love with the songs. And this is the first album. So not only did he do one, he then did two. And then he decided to do a third.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the same case of... he worked at it. He didn't just use the same lyrics. If he thought that something wasn't good for the way that he wanted to do the song, he would then say, can I change it to this? And obviously I want to make him as comfortable as he was. But that was what was so lovely for us. And I mean, we obviously had a lot of enthusiasm for the first album because we'd done it in an easy listening fashion to start with. Sure. We thought we'd missed out. We'd gone to Rochdale, Peter Hook's studio, to do that. And John Robb was producing to start with. And after a while, we had to ask him to leave. And then I produced it with another chap, another John who used to be in Loop. He came and looked after the drums and a few different things like that. And it was the start where I had to start doing the production myself from then. But right. We didn't think what we should have done is just scrapped it and started again. And because we were on a small label, we didn't think that would be right because other people's money was being used. Now, looking back on it, it was stupid. We should have just stopped and done it from scratch. And I think we would have had a damn easier life about it as well.
Are you still within touch with any of the Oasis guys now?
No. Ben sees Noel every now and then. We've not heard from Quigsy for a long time.
Most people haven't.
Well, I've seen Noel in Marylebone a few times, but It wasn't a case that we used to hang out with each other all the time. If we met each other like we did before the tour in a backstage, then we got on. That was that. I think Marcus Russell didn't particularly like our presence either.
Oh, really? because
we used to smoke a lot. And, hey, that's how it is.
There you go. Wonderful. And so what's next for you guys then? So obviously I know you don't tour anyway, so it's not like most musicians that now they're just pulling their hair out because they should be touring the new album and they aren't. So I suppose that hasn't been a difference for you, but what was the plan and what is the plan now?
Well, yeah, we stopped touring a few years ago and we just stick to doing the studio when we want. In a way, because the album's done so well, we're still sort of doing the admin behind it. We're still doing interviews and we're still pushing it. And I think we're about to repress for like the fifth time, which is very good. And it's slowly getting more traction in America as well. We hope that will build up. And that is it. We haven't really thought about too much other than that.
Mm. Like I said earlier, it would be great to get, you know, your worldview now, actually, on with everything else that's happening, because it feels prime for, you know, there's a lot to write about, basically.
Yeah, you see, I see everything in the prism of Brexit. I've probably seen my whole life in a prism of Brexit, because I was... I was born in Wolverhampton, where Enoch Powell was, and therefore growing up with lots of Powellites around me. And I see Brexit as Enoch Powell version 2. Mm. And the coronavirus is pretty bad, but I think it's also showing how things are going to be pretty much worse in the future because of the way that the government have handled coronavirus, which I think has been despicable. But they've got away with it. And I think Brexit, they haven't got a deal ready on Brexit, but I think they will probably get away with it. Mm. And I think that will be disastrous. I also think a lot of people were told how disastrous it was, especially in the music industry. And again, the music industry did a shit all, absolutely shit all, and may well deserve it. That might be what their comeuppance should be, because they should have been political. They should have had a wider view on it, and they didn't. You know, we spoke about it at every turn that we could. We wrote letters asking people for signatures, and some of the responses that we got, well, they've got no industry because of the coronavirus anyway, but they're not going to have it if Brexit goes as full throttle as the government seem to be alerting us that it will.
Mm. No, I know, and it's crazy when you think that you know, the creative arts, and especially music, is like one of the biggest exports, like even if you're just looking at it on a financial basis, not even taking into account all the mental health well-being of the creative arts, you know, even purely on a numbers basis for the number crunchers. Mm. It just makes sense, you know what I mean? It's just madness. I'm completely with you on that.
Yeah. And they've not got people from the industry, even on the boards, that will be looking after what will happen in the future. No one from music is there to represent music. But then again, I mean, the MU, what the fuck have they done anyway? What have they ever done? Nothing. They deserve to go down. They're atrocious.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Well, Tejinder, thank you so much, mate, for your time. I do really appreciate. I really appreciate the you taking the time.
No problem.
To the Oasis podcast. And yeah. And have you got a particular favourite Oasis track? I didn't warn you about this. But we tend to, you know, I edit in clips as we go, and we tend to finish with the favourite Oasis track of the guest's choice. So, is there one that particularly sticks out to you?
Well, I mean, Fading Out, it would be quite good, actually, because I think it's on I was told it's on a YouTube. That show is on.
Great, with the sitar.
The 8th of February at Atlanta, the Fox Theatre.
There we go. And that was the last show you did with them as well.
On that tour, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, we'll play it with that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, James. Thanks for that. Take care. To get on a roller coaster, the present time today, you gotta be bad enough to beat the brain. Get on a helter-skelter, opponent to the fray, you gotta be bad enough to beat the brain. You're fading out. You're fading out. You're fading out.
So thank you very much to Jinder Singh for that brilliant interview. And yeah, make sure you're checking out Corner Shop's back catalogue, especially their new album, England is a Garden, because it's absolutely brilliant. Really, really enjoyed that. And yeah, and if you can go and let the @CornerShopHQ Twitter know that you enjoyed the episode, on the Oasis podcast, that would be really cool. All right, before we leave it today, there's been a couple of audio messages coming, so we always like to play these. First off, this is one of our patrons, James Gates.
Hi, JC. First of all, could I say great work on the podcast. I love the kind of further reading and further listening recommendations that you put out there, and all the little clips of stuff in there is really well thought out. So how did I get into Oasis? I wasn't into them from the start, and I've been thinking recently about, well, where was I then? Where was I at? Well, having discovered Metallica at the beginning of the 90s, I was at Donington Monsters of Rock in 1995, where I also discovered Therapy. But I was aware of Oasis at the time and got into them. And as has been said on here before, it's more than just the music. They spoke to people and still do. So I got into them with Morning Glory, really, and then went back discovering more, so Definitely Maybe, and then singles. And then when Be Here Now was on the horizon, I was well into them and was pleased to be finally buying one of their albums on its release date. I only discovered the podcast last year, and I've been rapidly trying to catch up. I'm now just into the early lockdown episodes that you've put out. Looking forward to when things go back to some kind of normal, so I can hopefully get out to a live event and get myself a signed copy of the book as well. I think just finally, this kind of lockdown myth that maybe people have got a bit more time. Well, I don't have any more time due to lockdown, but if I did have more time, I was thinking I'd love to learn the guitar, because just listening to all of the episodes, it's just made me think, yeah, I could do it. I could pick up a guitar and play. Well, hopefully anyway. But yeah, I just remember walking around the supermarket listening to the Ricky Hatton episode with the Cast No Shadow, A to Z, and it was suggested that was a good beginner's tune to learn. And I just thought, yeah, I wouldn't mind some of that, learning some of that. But no time, unfortunately. But I keep it on the radar. So anyway, keep up the great work on a podcast, and I look forward to getting even more into it. Cheers, all the best, bye.
Cheers, James, thanks for that, much appreciated. And come on, mate, no excuses. Of course you've got time, even if it's only literally 10 minutes. You know, pick it up, pick up guitar, literally 10 minutes every day. So many guitarists I know, that's all they do. And that's enough. That's the cool thing. I'm not a guitarist at all, but I can just about play enough open chords to play Cast No Shadow, a couple of others, which, you know, it's just good. If people, there's a guitar kicking around, pick it up, knock out a bit of Live Forever or Cast No Shadow or Wonderwall. Just sounds very cool. Anyway, thanks very much for pinging that over. All right, this is a good one. This was a message from Lewis Walker, who got in touch with me on Instagram. And not really Oasis related, but it's funny. So here we go.
All right, James Bud, how are you doing? I'm sitting listening to the DMAs at Transmit last year, drinking fucking Red Stripe. Aye, the story. So my mum, I mean, I'm 25, so my mum started working in a butcher's in Fife in like the early 2000s, and that was when like Ian Brim was like coming out of jail, and he was like writing like loads of songs and that. So I was like only 7 at the time, and the only people I was interested in when I was 7 was Michael Jackson, that's a bit weird, Freddie Mercury and Europe, because I gave my uncle my MP3 player, and they're the only three songs he downloaded. Anyway, so Ian Brim came out and he was doing like small tours and that, and he'd under all the halls in Glen Office, which is East Fife. Like, Fife is basically near Edinburgh. And it was like 7:30 in the morning, and Ian Brim must have been like fucking came into the butcher's. My mum was a butcher at the time, and she served him, and she was like, holy fuck, I recognise you. I recognise you from somewhere. I mean, bear in mind, this is like 2002, 2003. I was like, what's your name? And he was like, oh, yeah, it's fucking Ian, man. Yeah, it's Ian. I was like, Ian, were you in my year at school? And the fucking manager burst out laughing, like, fucking hell, it's Ian Brown for the Stone Roses, you fucking idiot. And they've all got a picture in that. But I remember her showing me, like a couple of months later, and I'm like, I don't know who that is. But I've still got it in the house now, and I'll send you it for Instagram. It's fucking brilliant. I mean, imagine meeting, like, my mum's a massive Stone Roses fan. Like, one of her favourite songs of all time is the 10 Story Love song. And she never recognised them. I'll send you the photo for Instagram. It's fucking brilliant.
Thanks for that, Lewis. I thought it was going to be, oh, Ian Gallagher. But no, quality, good story. So it just reminds me to say thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. Thanks, most importantly, go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is and it makes a massive difference. Just to let you know that the Oasis podcast Patreon is now the Oasis podcast network Patreon, because as well as the Oasis podcast stuff, we're going to be doing bonus episodes for 1001 albums over there as well. So that's going to be the Oasis podcast network. And just to give you an update, I remember a while back I was looking to start a new music podcast called Shine a Light. Didn't end up happening just because basically lockdown happened. And a whole point of that is getting out to live gigs and watching bands and stuff. And with no gigs on, there was no real point in doing that podcast. So, but once things pick up again, then hopefully we'll get involved with that again. And so that could be three podcasts. And the other thing I'd like to do is some sort of more general, less, not necessarily music based, whether it's sport or film or TV, stuff like that, because I've lots of other interests and things. And if something you'd be interested in hearing about, let me know. Or if you just say shut up and just talk about Oasis because that's all we care about, that's fine too. All opinions are valid. Do please follow on Twitter and Facebook at Oasis Podcast, and Instagram is at Oasis Pod. You can always email me, oasispod@gmail.com. And please do write reviews of the podcast on iTunes for both Oasis Podcast and 1001 Albums. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
Do you reckon so? Yeah, I'll fucking see you.